This is the AdNonTech Podcast, conversations about education, technology, and culture, with Dr. Doug Reed and Dr. Matt Stranick. Thank you for joining us. Everybody, it's Matt Stranick, and this is the latest edition of the series of ongoing EdNonTech conversations. I'm really grateful just in the ones that are out in the public now and ones that are even recorded and are going to be recorded. And instead of the inestimable Dr. Doug Reed, I'm absolutely still thrilled and stoked. I am absolutely beyond thrilled and stoked to have besides, you know, many, many other things within my personal life, which I'm sure will crop up during this discussion, notably a very significant writer here in the Maritimes and increasingly, I think it's fair to say, across the national scene of thrillers, mysteries, cozy type suspense novels is what you specialize in, I think, and that is the rad, by all accounts of radness, by anybody who's ever come in contact with this man in any of his ways, including, I'm thrilled to say, as an author, Mr. Chuck Bowie.
Good morning, Matt. How are you?
I'm really good, Chuck. And again, I just really want to thank you for being here. In terms of the, you know, hyperbolic kind of opening gambit, I mean, it's just something where through trying to expand the format for this ostensibly education show, I just figure let's reach out to practicing professionals in various areas of endeavor to see, you know, what can be learned, essentially. And it's been a real thrill to use a term to sort of see you over the past, 10 or 15 years anyway, really diving into you've always been a literary guy. I know this since I was a child because that's how long me and your kids have been hanging out. I guess what I'll start out with, and this is true for all the interviews that we've done as kind of an opening gambit, for the people who might be unaware of your work, you know, such as education PhDs on LinkedIn or whatnot, who is Chuck?
Thank you. It was a very flattering introduction. I will say that I do describe myself in great part as being an author because it chews up a large amount of my day. I've been late to the game as a novelist. When I was younger, it was all about short stories, travel articles, whatever could get you a $50 paycheck over and above your salary to keep the kids accustomed to the lifestyle that they enjoyed. And now it's all about the extreme pleasure of writing coupled with the passion that is imbued into the writing to bathe me in endorphins and serotonins and all the good chemicals a lovely preoccupation will give you. So I started writing when I was young, but you know, I was late to the novel game, and at one point I found myself in Romania, in Bucharest. And I, my boss and I were installing a federal government platform for the government. It was one of those CETA international development opportunities that Canada won. And they sent me over to Bucharest. It was a lovely thing. But I woke up one morning in the second nicest hotel in the country. I woke up to a fully formed dream, thank God, that I remembered once I woke up. And I woke up to the sound of the dogs and the orphans playing in the street. And a fully formed contract thief had entered my late night dreaming. And so it was all
there.
That's
Coleridge, man. That's what happened with him and Kublai Khan. I remember having a conversation with your son, John, for those who don't know, in grade 10 English class. And we were talking, we were like studying the romantics. And we were like, me and John having this conversation about like, yeah, this guy hit the opium and then he had a dream and he wrote it down. It's you, I mean, without the opiates, clearly.
Setting that part aside.
Government work, which, you know. And thank you, Chuck, because my first opening gambit here. Folks, I've got 10 questions, and I'm going to be danged if we don't get through all of them, because as I was kind of mentioning to Chuck beforehand, there's so many rabbit holes we could go down. Because me and John have been friends since I was 5, so anybody who's following along at home knows that's quite some time ago. And, you know, I just to your significant career as a federal public servant, you know, where there may be something that kind of overlapped in terms of process or thinking or communication or representation that sort of carries into your mentality as a novelist. Does that make sense, pal?
It makes very good sense, and I will tell you that bleeding over from one life event into another, from one situational development into another, these things are they're messy. And yes. The irony is, I'm here to talk about writing books, and mm-hmm. The day that I retired from the Federal Public Service, I stopped a teeny bit early. That day, my first novel came out. So on Friday at 4:30, I said, crap, I have another hour's worth of work to do. I'll stay till 5:30. That's fine. Monday morning, 8:30, I was writing at my desk and had started a new career. There are times when the transition to so-called retirement is fraught. People don't understand that they're being paid to relax now. I, on the other hand, I didn't buy into that, because this amazing development landed in my lap. The transition from writing short stories and essays and things like that flipped on his head, and I will, toward the end of our discussion, I will tell you why this actually became significant, the notion of writing books full time. We'll get back to that after a little bit. I'll answer it in another way.
Is that the novelist technique of foreshadowing, Chuck? Are you dropping some literary approaches into this?
I delivered about a week or so ago, I delivered a workshop on how to establish and maintain continuity in the creation of a fictional series. And that's a big deal, you know, dropping red herrings, dropping little incidents and accidents, as Paul Simon would say.
Well, it's interesting. Yeah. To see like the cleavage, you know, the parallels between the writing enterprise, because, you know, to the majority of people who will at least first encounter this recording, they're coming from a background as educators. So in a classroom situation with sort of like, you tell them once and then middle of the time, you reinforce what you told them before. And then at the end, just to make sure that it kind of resonates, you give them something at the end. So
that's right. And usually that something at the end is, and this is what you heard.
Or if you're writing a suspense novel, and that was the last thing he heard, or yeah. she.
Now, one of the interesting things that I do in writing many of my novels, I've written eight now, plus some books of short stories. But in many of my novels, I will actually establish a premise and then link back to it again and again, making it stronger. But you know what? In many of my books, you know who the bad guy is early on in the game. So for me, it's not really about the what, it's more about the how and the why. And
that's so cool, Chuck.
Really
thoughtful. And again, in terms of me just kind of interjecting, it's really not out of a sense of rudeness. It's more just like, man, this guy is just twigging something here for me. And because what you're describing, the how and the why kind of questions, first of all, that is exactly the kind of thing that led me into being an educator primarily. But then also the mentality here, because I've engaged with various kinds of writers and have other kinds of writers even lined up after you for this show. Very, very thankful for that. So everybody kind of comes at this stuff with their own different perspective and standpoint. Yeah. So one of my scripted questions here, and I'll even throw in two of the scripted questions just to say that I maintained control of the interview despite my effusions, is that, first of all, what is it? I think, you know, as I recall from when I was younger, you were kind of initially into science fiction and fantasy as a mode, and then you kind of made a transition into the suspense sort of area, and you've kind of been running at it full steam. And even, I would say, I mean, you describe what you write as so-called the cozy kind of style of noir fiction, if we can call it that. And
for
so
one,
when you're sort of pursuing these how and these why, expressing all that through the vehicle of a sort of single lead character, I guess what I really want to ask is, Chuck, tell us about Donovan.
See, now Donovan is not a cozy mystery guy. He's the guy who appeared uninvited in my dreams all those years ago back in Bucharest. And what happened was I woke up, as I say, to the sound of the dogs and the orphans playing in the street outside a hotel way beyond my budget. But here we are in a country that was struggling financially, and the federal government was paying my dime to do some good hard work. So I was living guilt-free in a marble-encrusted hotel room with the window open. It was 26 degrees Celsius in October. All the signs were pointing to me having a good life that month. And so I woke up to this guy, no conscience, not a very nice fellow, clearly a broken person. And I delve into that early in the book, just how bad off his childhood was. But effectively, he would travel anywhere in the world and separate people from their possessions if you paid him enough. And so it sounds like a great life, and he was making millions. But imagine, he's not James Bond, he's some Canadian guy. And so he would get beaten up on the regular, and things would not go well for him, but he would prevail because Canadian. And so what would happen is he would fly into a lovely city in the world, let's say London, and he would do the deed, get the crime, deal with whatever had to be done from business perspective, and then get out. What did he see in that country? A hotel room and an art gallery, a hotel room and a museum, a hotel room and a rich person's residence. So no life, no girlfriend, no attachments whatsoever. He was a lone wolf approaching 40 years old, nothing to show for it but money. Some people would say that's a pretty nice place to be, but the days are long when you have nothing but violence and a paycheck to look forward to. So I just thought, wow, I think I have to talk about this guy. And so he begins the process of committing three crimes. I like the number three. There's I think it's maybe a little bit of my ancient Catholic background. I don't know, but there's some theological elements to it. And again, I'm dealing with broken people who are seeking redemption. And so my man Donovan commits three crimes in book one, and then has a bit of an epiphany by having a conversation with somebody.
Question.
I love the question.
Okay, so why Amicat as the title? Because I'm sorry, dude. It is an act of marketing. Like I'm in a profession fraught with just weird acronyms. So I'm like,
yes.
Amicat. Like, is it because like I don't know what that is? I saw it come up on the book. I'm like, huh. There's literally no clue from that title what this book could be about. Just a random kind of tertiary question, dude.
Yeah, so that's book two. And you may recall that I worked for the feds, and so we liked our acronyms way back then. And some of them would work really well, and some of them did not. So okay. the Canadian Organization of Women, an unfortunate acronym. So you tend to stay clear of those kinds of acronyms. But gotcha. I'm writing away, and in book two, I have three crimes as well. And so in book two, I write about a mask, a cask, and a task. And I just thought, my editors would not like me to be that kind of childishly clever all the time. But I insisted on getting away with it this time. So my editor at the publisher looked at the title and she said, "What's that all about, Chuck?" I said what it was, and she said, "You know, here was my first thought. My name is Donovan and I am a cat burglar." So there's the "am a cat." But that was nothing like what I was trying to do. I just wanted to identify that a mask would be involved, a cask of wine would be involved, and a task based on a murder would be involved. So indulged myself. It's an indulgence.
I think that's highly adult. And my first thing is, literary influences. I mean, mask and a cask, to me, that's Poe, right?
Edgar Allan Poe.
Yeah, right? So I guess, I mean, as long as I've known you, I have some like clear recollections of what was that awesome bookstore on the north side with Gus, you know, Gus, the proprietor, because I have some awesome memories of going there with my grandparents who lived out on the Parallel Road and, you know, picking up comics and chatting with them. And he knew I had some nascent interest in writing or whatever. And to the extent that he conversed with me. And I remember John saying, "Yeah, my dad's really good friends with that guy." And it just seemed like because Gus had some, you know, experience as a science fiction writer, as I recall. And I just sort of think, wow, in terms of like grassroots regional, you know, activity, you are somebody who has engaged with it since before you became, quote unquote, a professional writer. And then since you've really thrown yourself into the writers union, writers groups, hosting seminars, as you've already referred to. I mean, do you see all of those kinds of activities as being sort of part of the same cloth of the act of writing? Or do you see it as kind of, you know, totally separate processes and wavelengths? Again, sorry for the kind of quasi jumping around here. I was curious about that.
Well, I'm going to grab your metaphor and stretch it out, beginning with the word cloth. We'll go to the word tapestry. And as you look at the medieval and Renaissance tapestries, you'll see, let's say, the Jesus or Mary figure in the middle of it, or the battle in the middle of it. But if you go to the periphery of the tapestries, you see all the little elements that help enrich the image. And so Gus Fennell, we still have coffee on the regular.
Awesome.
He has stopped operating a bookstore, and just like me, and this is step two of that little point I wanted to make at the beginning. Just like me, he's focusing on what gives him pleasure, which is to sell collectibles online.
Awesome.
And so he's shrunk the breadth of his interest in book sales to do exactly what he wants.
Awesome.
As a bookseller. And so too, it was the same thing for me. I have books of short stories, a few anthologies, like the Autumn Paths, Spring Paths, Summer Paths, Winter Paths collections. And I have recently said I can't participate in the next iteration, which I think is going to be maybe Earth, Air, Fire, and Water. Who knows? But the authors will continue without me, because all I want to do is write mysteries, you know?
That's the latest, right?
Is the latest. We'll talk about that in a minute. I just wanted to reiterate that Gus did focus on SF and fantasy, and I would grab elements from him to enrich my learning around books. And you know very well that the pedagogy of life suggests that you will get a big chunk of what you need to know from a classroom, but you'll also grab a teeny bit of life as you step outside the classroom and meet the bully.
100%. You know?
So,
yes,
that kind of thing happened to me and was hammered home by, no pun intended, by Gus, in that I would read his work, and there would be his hero would be performing some act of serious violence, and then he would be doing some little task afterward, and you had to laugh right out loud at the ridiculousness and humor of a very human act. And sometimes that very human act is resentment and bitterness, or you know, just pure spite, malevolent spite. But that doesn't define the character. I don't like my characters to be all black or all white, because that's not real life. So I learned a few little tricks from Gus that served me in good stead.
So cool. Again, sorry to kind of throw you something out of left field. That was not among the scripted questions.
But
as we sort of
bring
go
it on.
Further, but as we go further into this conversation, I mean, I guess what I'm sort of, you know, my memories of childhood are really interlinked in one way or another with, you know, John and Matt and you know, your family. And it's really been a blessing to me to have that sort of in my life as a constant, you know, since I was a very young age. A lot of people just, you know, don't have those kinds of relationships over time. And, you know, as I think about my engagements with you specifically, a lot of that, I mean, I think we both recognized something in each other earlier where, you know, narrative was something for each of us, right? Because, you know, I'd get up in the morning before John when I stayed at your place, and, you know, you'd be waiting there with the Globe and Mail, and we'd have that kind of chat. And, you know, it's like you think, okay, you don't think maybe much of it in the moment. But then certainly as I've come into my middle age and I sort of start taking stock of, you know, not just who I am now, but how and why.
Yeah.
You kind of look back at certain experiences that resonate, you know, with the decades in between. And you go, okay, that may have been something that kind of helped set me on the path that I'm on my way now. And for me, that, you know, narrative, poetry, short stories, as you say, you know, you got to try all of it. You got to just kind of find. I just think, you know, some of these anecdotes that you're sharing and some of these moments you shared with us so far have just been really, you know, they really land. They have a real, you know, pitch to them because they're born of your real life. So do you want to speak more about what the day of a novelist looks like? Because a lot of us don't actually know. And that's kind of part of what we're trying to do with the show, bring in viewpoints and perspectives that we wouldn't necessarily have otherwise. What's it like being a full-time writer, Chuck?
Okay. thank you. The day begins about an hour before I wake up. I am a dreamer. I am a sometimes I call them fever dreams, where I'm overloaded by images and half-formed paths. I have once described myself as being inside my head. It's like, okay, the sheriff steps out of the Who's Gow in 1867, and he's looking at the posse, and he says, Black Bart is out there somewhere. What I need you to do is go and get him. So the seven riders turn around and they flee off in all directions toward the Black Hills, but not the same Black Hill. And who knows what they're going to bring back. That's my brain. That is how my brain is wired.
That is tight. I want to see what happens next when you describe that, man. That is sick. Sorry, but I mean, that sounds rad. That's a very cool gift that your process is giving you in a way.
Yes.
And that's just years of subconscious training and effort, because I actually, like, as somebody who studies how people learn, I really think that there's so much we don't know about the subconscious, but if you can sort of program it a bit, finesse it a bit so that, you know, certain outputs are valued from your function, then, you know, the underlying program starts to kind of contribute a bit with those outputs that kind of bubble up. And so what you're describing just sounds totally like you've got a well, you know, organized mechanism kind of humming away, which speaks to a good balance within the whole, actually. I mean, again, just from the outside looking in, Chuck, that's how it seems to me from my educative standpoint.
It's a bit Jungian in the sense that I believe that I go to bed and once I fall asleep, my dreams are comprised of worries, experiences, and emotions that pull together to help me process what the hell is going on in my life. And so it's not a surprise to me that in the hours before I wake, that many of my thoughts are concerned with the workday that I now enjoy, the
right.
writing. And so so I awaken and I try to understand what it is that I've experienced. And I am the guy who now I have the luxury of awakening early, but not leaping out of bed. So I'm there. I'm in this somnolent state where I am processing like hell, but not. It doesn't appear that I'm doing anything. Anyway, then I get up and I coffee myself up and get a little bit attuned to the day. My wife and I make our plans. We analyze what has happened and what will happen, and then I make a lunch, and then set to work. So I now work in the afternoons. Now, I would like to talk about the difference between writing and what I call writage.
Fantastic. And,
the job of a writer as you're completing their first novel is just to write. So I'm an intuitive writer, so as Stephen King says. So I sit and we're harkening back 10 years. I'm writing the first novel, and it's just, well, what's happening next? Oh my God, you'll never guess what Donovan did today. That type of thing is taking place. But finish book one, and now you're in book two, and your publisher is at you, and she's saying, you know, book two writes book one, book two sells book one. So with those two concepts in mind, get going. But that's all well and good for a publisher or an editor to say. But now what's happening with book two is the Writers Federation of New Brunswick is saying, shouldn't you be a member? Well, maybe I should. If I had time, I would apply. Well, it's easy to apply. Now is a good time. Stop writing and do this little 20-minute thing. And that only amplifies and expands in breadth. It's just like that expanding foam that you put in the windows to insulate your windows. It, you put in a little bit, next thing you know, it's going all over the bottom of the window because you put too much in. It's expanding foam. Well, my expanding responsibilities around marketing, promotion, creation and development, these things expand. And so what happens is my life of leisure in the mornings gets chewed up. And so I do all that crap in the morning when I can.
And then so put then, yourself in leisure for the remainder of the day. Is that kind of what happens? And you're in your happy zone, in your, like, just explore and document kind of mode, right?
Yes, I become a creative at 1 o'clock, regardless. There's a, I think it was Aldous Huxley, perhaps, who said, you know, I'm the kind of writer who writes when I want. Fortunately, I want to Monday to Friday from 9 to 5, you know, so it's the application of discipline around writing is there, even if you are like me, an intuitive creative, you still have to apply the seat of the pants to the seat of the chair. And so we have to work through the rigor of doing the writage in order to enjoy the absolute pleasure of sitting down and saying, okay, drop your ideas onto my head, Muse, because I am ready. I'm waiting for you. And so that's how my afternoons go. These days, I have a deadline for my latest novel. I'm approaching 50,000 words. I like my books to come in around 80,000. So, you know, I'm kind of seeing how it's going to unfold. So what happens is, let's say my wife, my partner, has an evening with friends. Well, then I sneak in here and I drop another hour's worth of creativity.
Sneak in. You kind of grab it where you can. And that's
yes.
So for people who think, and I'm sorry to sort of, again, shoehorn in here, but I think, like, for people who, there's so many people who are just sort of like, well, I'd write a novel if, you know, I have this thing, which I think would make a great book, but it's actually, as you kind of describe, the application on the regular of settings and conditions which will permit the mechanism to be receptive and be able to kind of provide what is ultimately going to be, because there's nothing wrong with a hobbyist. There's nothing who's just going to, like, I wrote a couple stories, I wrote a couple poems. Frankly, I think, or I wrote in a botched, terrible half of a first novel. There's so much reward to be had from those kind of ad hoc kind of creative endeavors. And I think as an educator, I wish we could, you know, in the schools particularly, just let people know, like, it's really cool to do bad art. But if you want to sort of have it as part of your life, you know, bring it to its widest possible audience, you kind of got to think of it as a work process. You kind of got to think of it as like, this is a professional output of some variety, which I am passionate about, but still you kind of want to bring a professional discipline mentality to it in order to be sort of recognized as something that other people besides you will get some kind of value out of, right?
I mean, that's right.
This is what we're trying to do with this podcast, and I'm sorry to monopolize these moments, but you've really kind of set off a lot of just, how does the whole endeavor situate as a creative thing, right?
Yep. So you set out to write for yourself. I write for me.
Yes.
And then at a certain point, it occurs to me that what I'm writing might be give pleasure to other people. See, I write brain candy. I write for entertainment. There may be a life lesson in there. It fell in there by accident. So I am a person who wants to write to entertain. Awesome. Mark Twain. Can I give you my favorite, one of my favorite all-time quotes? This was
Please
Mark
do.
Twain. Mark Twain said, you know, some people write champagne and some people write water. I write water. Everybody drinks water. So I take comfort in knowing that if I am writing a book that will be just absolutely a pleasure for someone who's on vacation or going to the beach or hopping on a plane or just wants to escape from life for an hour before bed, I'm your man. I'm the guy who will help you to get to where you want to go by dumping you right into the fire of a suspense thriller where bad things happen, and you know at by the end of the book, you're going to be okay. You'll just put the book down and say, oh my gosh, what a ride. That was just fun. And so I am absolutely content to get my awards from book sales. And on that note, you had asked earlier about science fiction. Yes,
yeah.
I started out after writing short stories. I was learning how to write, and I wrote, I don't know, 60 pages of a romance, and it was great. I stopped one page. I stopped and said, I can't do this because it's not me. It's not what I want to do. I'm going to write a science fiction novel. And I wrote that one and I finished it. 94,000 words. It was horrible for the most part, but it was, it taught me so much. And there's a kernel of brilliance. I'm being immodest. There's a kernel of brilliance in an otherwise crappy novel. And I was having a chat, and by chat I mean a glass of wine with my wife, who knows more about the writing of mysteries than I'll ever learn. I think she was saying, you know, your book didn't have to be in the future, and your book didn't have to be about space and excitement going from Earth to Mars. It really is about those two little girls who show up on page 80 and who steal the book away from the male and female protagonist. And it's that's where the brilliance lies, in the experience of these two little girls. I won't say any more about it because you never know. I might finish with mysteries someday and say, I guess I'll write that book about what would happen, and I won't say, with these two little girls.
Serious shout out to Lois, man. Can I just say, because we're kind of getting into the later part here, and I really, for your sake, as much as for anybody who's listening to the duration of this, one of my kind of later questions here, bud, because, I mean, first of all, thank you so much for sharing the insights into, you know, what your creative process is, because my feeling as I grow older is, as you sort of alluded to, these areas of life and endeavor are so not, you know, removed from each other. So if you're talking about your creative process as a novelist, I think people as educators, people as musicians, anybody who sort of has these kind of outputs that they are passionate about and require dedication, training, commitment, and putting yourself out there for often very scathing public experiences as a necessary function of what you're doing. I mean, I've just had so much joy watching your evolution through our social media and shared connections, just watching you build this awesome platform, just knowing that this guy who's just been rad about carrying out high-level work for our government, doing very cool things, just seamlessly, it seems, and I know there's a whole tortured history of art behind it, but, yeah. You know, as you say, you started your new job after staying your full day. Like, that just blows my mind. I'm like, dudes, I'm getting a 12-pack. I'm using my last sick day. You're like, I'm going to show up at one desk. Next day, I'm showing up at another. So thanks a lot for sharing all of this with me. I do have to ask you, as we sort of start to wind things down, besides, yeah. You know, what you're working on now, besides your passion and project now, which I do want to ask, that's the real last question. But I mean, you got two awesome creative kids. At this point, you have grandkids who are super creative, right? Yes. You have a granddaughter who is, you know, reciting poetry in competitions, in literary competitions. Yeah. I mean, John is just
at age 14.
Yeah, right. And then you have, like, you know, John and Matt are both so deeply into music and always have been. I mean, so, like, what is it about being sort of a patriarch as a creative guy who's a patriarch, brilliant creative partner in Lois, brilliant, you know, kids who are, you know, confident and exploring themselves and expressing themselves through music and writing and all these other things. I mean, Chuck, I've been trying to figure out the secret sauce my whole life. Just what's that even all about?
I was married as a young man who was oblivious to life.
Okay.
I always felt that this is a sad confession. I always felt that a cheerful approach and a willingness to do stuff that I didn't even know I could do was the way to start. And then I happened upon the right person who supported me. If you have somebody, it doesn't have to be a life partner. If you have somebody who says what you're doing has some value and it should be explored, then you're there. So for instance, you've had cheerleaders in me and in my son Jonathan in how you go about becoming Dr. Matthew Stranick. And this journey that you're on suggests that the positive support from your father Bob and all of the people around you, coupled with the friends and supporters like me, that can't help but normalize the progress that you can make as a person who sets down a path. And so it's not different for me. I coincidentally marry somebody who was right for me. And so years later, I'm writing my first novel, and my wife has degrees in English and French literature and is absolutely passionate about reading mysteries. What the hell? It's life was set up for me. I can't script that. I can only appreciate that the universe was kind of kind to me.
Awesome.
Because I didn't really have a lot of firm goals when I started out. I was open to things and willing to work. And so when things happened for me, I made an effort to make them succeed. But that's the best I can offer you for how did things happen for me.
Being open to what the universe provides and being in the best situation mentally, whatever, that you can be, to be able to act on the moments that are provided, I think is a very, very common aspect of any kind of creative endeavor. Even, you know, as you say, people who don't necessarily see themselves in, you know, creative, quote unquote, industries or roles. It's like sort of, if you have a gift for, you know, playing hockey, if you have a gift for, you know, building things with your hands and the trades or construction, if you can sort of bring the openness to the joy and the talent, you know, that can be provided. And if you sort of pursue that with kind of diligence and, you know, a willingness to see where it goes, I really think that you're speaking to a very strong aspect of what makes people tick as creative individuals, bro. So thank you. That is awesome. Life lessons from Chuck. I have the benefit of knowing this man and his family for more than 40 years. You might not, but trust me, it's just, it's all good in those kinds of ways. Chuck, what are you working on now? What's your thing that you're most excited about now as a writer? And then plus, you know, from the writage, as you say, but really as a writer, what's making you tick?
Okay. Thank you. I had mentioned at the beginning that I want to focus on writing mysteries. I am of an age where I should be allowed to do what I want if I can afford it. And so that said, I have stopped writing. I haven't stopped writing short stories. I've stopped working with others to add short stories to anthologies because I feel like I don't have time. I want to focus on what you might call your passion project. Okay. So my passion project is to write a damn good mystery. And my editor says, above all, write a better book than the one you just wrote.
Whoa.
And so that's where my focus is. So I am under one of my pseudonyms. Well, my other pseudonym, I have written a cozy mystery series up where it's a love letter to a small maritime town. And it's a cozy mystery. So therefore it's kinder, gentler, warmer, funnier, a lot more food involved, but I still kill people and I still solve the mystery, but I do it as Alexa Bowie.
Good Lord. I didn't even know about, like, I was like, you know, there's so many Bowies. There's so many Bowies.
Yeah.
And I'm fortunate, right? Besides even like above, you know, just the immediate Fredericton, North Side, you know, Bowies, you know, I've had opportunities to meet the Miramichi crowd, for instance, you know, variously and in various ways. And so, you know, I'm looking at your author webpage, like literally 20 minutes before we start to record this thing, just like, okay. And definitely, folks, you can buy all of these books on the website. It's actually very professional. I was sort of like, I wonder if he needs any WordPress. I'm like, nah, he's good. He's got professional support from his publisher for this kind of thing, I suppose. I saw Alexa Bowie. I'm like, must be one of them Bowies I just haven't occurred. And also has a, okay. So you've outed your pseudonym. It's on your, and on all of these books. Good Lord, Chuck. So you have twice as many books almost than I had even, like how many books in the Alexa Bowie series?
Three books in Alexa Bowie, and the fourth one, as Balzac would say, is done. I just have to write it. So the fourth one is in my head. And then I have five thrillers where this is number five, Her Irish Boyfriend. He's very bad, by the way. I am over half through book six. In this series, about a contract thief seeking an international contract thief seeking redemption. I am writing book six that is set in Dublin and in London. And so this one had many scenes in Ireland, and I think this was a romp, a really fun book about four quite dark crimes. And the sixth book, the one I'm writing now, is almost like a follow up. Most of my books have a little elements of the book before them in them.
Cool.
And so this one is about an idealistic young Irish woman who has decided that the theft of Irish artifacts must stop. She has to go to London, steal the artifacts back, and bring them back to her country.
Man.
And at a certain point, Anya, my little Irish thief, just before she commits the first big crime, she has a change of heart, has a suspicion that maybe those things that are being stolen are not going to make it back to Ireland. Maybe they're being hived off by less conscientious people. And so she turns from a thief to a kidnapper in the space of 5 minutes. And a kidnappee.
Oh, so, well, still.
Which is why and I'll reveal this for the first time publicly, that my new book is going to be called Lost in London. And so she was kidnapped by the gang of thieves, and all of a sudden she's now, you know, in a locked room above an abandoned machine shop in St. John's Wood, London. So lots of fun.
Dang.
Having such fun.
And sitting down every day and just letting that happen for a few hours. I mean, you've literally, Chuck, you blow my mind, you know, because in the past 5 minutes, you know, within the last 10 minutes of this interview, you've like literally doubled my perceived knowledge of your, you know, bibliography. And just there's so much to dive into. And this is why we have pretty extensive notes that go with the show, because, you know, we don't need to hear me sort of effusing on about this towards the end. But everything you're describing sounds highly rad. The real last question, just because of what you've little bits and pieces of that kind of trickle in through Facebook, and then coupled with, you know, what you just described. I mean, I know you to be a very fastidious, you know, detailed, analytical guy, which served you extremely well as a civil servant. You know, those specialized skills that Liam Neeson has, you know, in those films. And I just travel, bro. You're talking London, you're talking Irish, you know, Ireland. I know France has been part of your mix. So, I mean, I know that if you're going to write about these locations, just knowing the kind of person you are, you're going to want to have the details correct. You're going to want to have the locales, the scenes, the smells, the milieu, you know, of these areas.
100%.
So do you want to just, again, full-time writer, folks, regionally located, expanding on various platforms, has about 15 books either in the can or on the go. And he's pulled this off, folks, within 10 to 15 years, give or take, right? I think it's fair to say, Chuck. So,
yeah,
I mean, just tell me about the travel aspect of this, because there's so many other things, and that'll be kind of a nice way to go out, because you've described some very cool experiences. A lot of them involving food, a few of them involving wine. And I just, you've talked about how this kind of informs some of the goings on in your worlds, right? In your fictional worlds.
Yes. Yeah.
Must be fun, man.
Well, it really is. So very quickly, I will tell you that Jane Austen will underscore the fact that write what you know doesn't necessarily mean traveling all over the world. You can still travel all over the mind, society, and sensibilities of of a community and get a very rich story out of that without travel.
Okay.
Ernest Hemingway would beg to differ. And so if he's going to write about being an ambulance driver in Italy, you know, or in Spain rather, you had better understand that he's writing what he knows. And so I will tell you that despite the fact that some writers say you don't have to write what you know, that's what fiction is all about, writing what you imagine. Sure, that's fine. But I know what it smells like when you enter an alleyway in Bucharest in the French Quarter, the Romani area of Bucharest. And so I can tell you what it smells like.
Yes.
And if you are on a Gulfstream flying from A to B, from London to Romania, I have a small understanding of that, but I have a real understanding of what it's like when you land in London or in Bucharest or in the south of France, that sort of thing. So I imbue my writing with these with the five senses as you are going there. So
very much.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Man, I would really want to even keep it going longer. But I think you know, in the interests of preserving the integrity of a somewhat hopefully legit interview, because I just enjoy this a lot. I enjoy every opportunity to speak with you, Chuck. So kind of getting to actually spend some time about, you know, hearing about this aspect of your life, which I just think, you know, what's going to be in a certain setting that's going to be of the most educational value, for want of another term. So for me, I'm like, huh, you know, Chuck's an awesome guy. Lots of people know that. Chuck's an awesome writer. Maybe not enough people know that. Chuck is a very creative individual, and for sure, that is something that I think anybody would want to know more about, which is something that, you know, hopefully the show seeks to encapsulate to some degree. So just, well, thanks a lot, Chuck, really, I swear.
You're welcome. Maybe you'll have me back and I can talk more about the process of actually writing a book or writing a series, and we can delve a little bit into the discipline of being a writer. Not
that.
About the writer's day so much as what happens between page
process
one
and craft, folks.
Yeah.
Process and craft. It's about
I could come back.
That would be awesome. I would love that so much. Maybe we can even, you know, tie that in to have some cachet in terms of like a book release kind of you know, kind of conversation or something.
Okay, wow. Well, that's going to happen late this fall, so we'll
fantastic.
See.
Fantastic. I'm already looking forward to our next chat. Is there anything we didn't get to here that you want to kind of say just before we sign off? Anything you want to kind of shout out or speak to? Anything new or cool?
No, I would just quietly affirm that if you have an idea for a book, then it's not enough to wish that you could write it. You know, Dorothy Parker says, "I hate writing. I love having written." And I think that the potential writers have to not talk about writing a book, but actually write their book. That's it.
I couldn't think of a better way to end this conversation, Chuck. Thank you so much. It's been a real privilege to have you here, and I'm really glad that you're going to be back.
Well, this was fun for me. You asked all the questions I wish that you would have asked. Thank you.
Fantastic. Thanks a lot, everybody. I'm going to end the recording now. Bye for now. Thank you.